Hello, I'm Sarah Schofield, Chief Executive for Grayling, Europe, UK and Ireland. And a huge welcome to our first Big Thinking Breakfast in partnership with Bocomi. I'm very sorry we're not meeting you in person today, but I'm enormously pleased to bring our conversation with top epidemiologist Adam Kucharski to you at home. I really hope you find what he has to say about contagion and communication both stimulating and thought-provoking, particularly at the moment as we navigate these very challenging times together. Meanwhile, please stay safe, and I really hope to see you all in person as soon as possible. Many thanks, and Richard, over to you.
Thank you, Sarah. I'm Bocomi founder Rich Kilgariff. Because of the COVID-19 crisis, we're keeping our distance but staying online and on schedule so that our partners and friends still have access to the brightest minds and the big thinking that keeps us all ahead of the curve across business, science, technology and culture. Adam Kucharski is perfectly placed to think big about our current situation. As Associate Professor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine, he's worked on global outbreaks such as the Ebola epidemic and the Zika virus. He's an award-winning TED Fellow and writes for The Observer, The FT, Scientific American and New Statesman. Are there three insights on contagion that still hold true?
Yeah, and so I think three things that can be really useful for thinking about how things spread and understanding outbreaks. The first is measuring how much transmission is actually happening. So can we actually put a number, you know, when we say something's contagious, what do we mean by that? And a measure we often use in infectious disease is what we call a reproduction number. So for each person who's infectious, how many people do they give it to? And so for something like COVID-19, each person on average is giving it to two or three people. Actually, it turns out for a lot of viral content on Facebook, it's very similar. On average, each person shares it with a couple more. And that gives you a sense of kind of each step of transmission, how much growth you might expect. So if on average you're sharing it to two other people, you'd go from one on average to two to four to eight, kind of doubling. So I think that's the first thing that's really useful to have, is some number that you can actually put on how much transmission is happening at each step. The second thing, though, that I think is really important to think about is the timescales we're talking about. So I mentioned COVID-19, yeah, each person can give it to a couple of others. That's also similar of some viral content on Facebook. Think of things like the Ice Bucket Challenge, where everyone was nominating a couple of other people. But the timescales of those are very different. COVID-19, that process of transmission takes a few days, whereas online, you know, sharing, there's evidence that someone sees a post within about 20 seconds or so, they might share it. So that really condenses the timescales that you're working on and the outbreaks that you're going to see. I think the third thing we also need to think about, though, is the social interactions that drive outbreaks, and particularly the variability that you can get in those. I think we often have this idea of contagion as this kind of clockwork process that, you know, I infect so many people and then each of those infects the same number of people and so on. But what we often see are these so-called super spreading events. For example, in SARS back in 2003, a lot of transmission was actually concentrated in a fairly small number of events. And we see something similar with kind of viral online content, that studies have found that there's these kind of so-called broadcast events where, you know, maybe a media outlet or celebrity shares something and it spreads to a lot of people. And then you get these small clusters of infection or sharing that happen subsequently. But really, without that mass exposure event at the start, you wouldn't get an outbreak. And we see something similar with kind of COVID-19 in Korea. We had that mass exposure event associated with that church, and that's what sparked transmissions. We have to think about those interactions as well.
Would you add the cultural element to that third point, that the way people interact and socialize affects the way an outbreak occurs and the speed?
I think definitely. And we also, I mean, another thing to be really conscious of is different types of contagion will require different kinds of interactions. So for example, a lot of us might see a funny cat video online and be pretty happy to share it. But if we encounter quite a tough, nuanced political view, we're probably going to need more social reinforcement. We're probably going to need to talk to more people and get that kind of more feedback before we adopt it. So, for example, when people put the equal sign on their Facebook profile a few years ago to support marriage equality, generally people would only do that after several of their friends had done it already. So it wasn't something where you'd see an acquaintance do it and adopt it. So the sort of behavior that we're either maybe encouraging or seeing spread really depends on those kind of the culture and the group dynamics that you're in, as well as the content itself.
Generally, communication and marketing is about trying to get things to catch on, whereas health agencies are always trying to get things to stop. Are you finding this different to anything you've ever worked on before? Because you say it in the book, you know, if you've seen one pandemic, you've seen one pandemic. There is no link between the past, the present, and the future. Is that the challenge?
It is. And I think there's certainly a lot we can learn, as I mentioned, in terms of our ability to understand timescales, understand magnitude. You know, we are seeing similarities with a number of the top level aspects. So, you know, now our ability to get a sense of what outbreak curves will look like in a new country early on are pretty good, because you see this almost clockwork like exponential growth happening at the start. But the question is really in those details. I think that analogy with marketing is kind of an interesting one, because my wife works in advertising, so that's kind of her a lot of her aim. But really, I think both sort of outbreak response and marketing have a similarity in that there's an element that you want a really effective and efficient way of either getting something to spread or control. So you want to look for those links in the transmission, which are particularly important. And that's what both fields are trying to do. And I think the situation we've got at the moment with COVID-19, where we're taking this blanket strategy, it's almost, I guess, the marketing equivalent of just sending a message to absolutely everyone in the population with absolutely no real understanding of how you can target that more effectively. And that's the situation we're in, because we know this thing spreads. It's very hard to identify ahead of time those key links in transmission, because people might not show symptoms, because a lot of different interactions may be driving this. And so the control we're adopting is almost this kind of just mass approach, where we're not, yeah, some countries are doing early on targeting, you know, we're just saying we've got to keep everyone apart, because actually we can't do anything at the moment more refined than that and be confident we can contain it.
The book is packed with phrases that are new to me as well, and will be to many readers, but actually some of which have become part of our lexicon in recent weeks. But information laundering and astroturfing, what do you mean by information laundering, and how does that affect the spread of an outbreak or the
One of the things I found fascinating in research in the book is, particularly online, there's so much that's been written about it, and you almost have to sift really through to get to the research and the studies kind of underlying these things. And one of the things I found really interesting is what's apparently quite a paradox, that if you look at really rigorous studies of information during things like the Brexit campaign and things like the US 2016 election, there's not really much evidence that a lot of people were exposed to these dodgy news sites or dodgy Twitter accounts. Most people got the information from very familiar news sources. So on that side, it seems that all this kind of fake news, all this manipulation wasn't really an issue. But on the other hand, if you go back down the chain and you look at where some of these talking points emerged, you find that actually often there are these kind of fringe groups and quite extreme organizations and people trying to put these information into the public sphere who do play a role. And so the way to kind of link these two seemingly contradictory things together is, as a lot of researchers are doing, is to look at actually who those kind of fringe groups are targeting. And in many cases, they're not trying to do mass messaging. They're not trying to get onto your Twitter feed. What they're trying to do is pepper journalists and politicians with messages so their point gets picked up. And this is the information laundering idea, that actually you will see a message because it's appeared in a newspaper, but the origins of that message may have come from a very different source. So you kind of see it from a trusted information source. And that, it's not a new idea. The KGB were doing that in their disinformation. It was trying to get media pickup. And with my few interactions over the media over the years, I've sometimes seen that happen, where I'll say something and then it will get kind of filtered through. And this idea of astroturfing feeds into that, because tools like Twitter and online platforms can be, if you use them cleverly, you can give the illusion that there's, for example, mass grassroots support. That's where astroturfing comes in. It's kind of the artificial impression that there's grassroots demand for something. And you do have groups who are kind of flooding politicians' accounts with certain views or advocacy So the politician has this idea that actually there's a lot of public support for this, when in reality they're being manipulated into thinking this is a more important talking point than it is.
So would you say that leads to epidemiological errors? Fake news leads to, what do you mean by that?
So I think what happens often when people look at outbreaks is you sort of look at the first step of logic. And so, for example, we have seen people looking at where people get their information and say, well, you know, everyone gets the information from mainstream sources, so these dubious Twitter accounts clearly aren't doing anything relevant. Or you look at the other side and you say, you know, people who look at these Twitter accounts, and there's evidence, for example, of, you know, 10 million people saw, say, a particular piece of content, and people saying this is a massive problem, until you realize that there are trillions and trillions of exposures to content online every day. So it's a very small fraction. So I think in epidemiology, it's very tempting when you see a data set to just glance at the headline figure and make a conclusion on it. But you have to think much more about the dynamics of, you know, how many people are actually seeing this? Where is it going next? And I think, yeah, even when we talk, when we look at platforms, you know, we'll look at what's happening on Twitter and we'll forget that content is then getting picked up in media, is making its way onto Facebook. And we're not really thinking about that full chain of transmission.
It is interesting. I mean, you talk about a story that you were involved with a few years ago, started doing the rounds, and you were at the middle of that outbreak of that story. And you noticed firsthand how you ended up on, you know, you started off on online, or you started off sharing something, and then you're on the Today program. And that is the new site. It's still quite traditional, isn't it? It's oddly, that's kind of how it used to be. That, you know, we used to, when I used to work on a discussion show or a feature show, we'd pick up the papers, we'd go through every story, we'd pick, literally cut out the stories. And then we'd amass a program, but then we would influence the next program. And by the end of the day, especially if you're listening to me today, you see how the news filters through the day, whatever, and then it starts again. But it's oddly traditional. And I think, I wonder what your perspective is on this, that because the news today is so stark and so real and so serious, that it's almost pushing aside all the nonsense, really. Although, yes, there's viral trends, there's misinformation flowing around, but we're all going to that broadcast in the evening. We're looking towards that broadcast. Now, does that make things easier from an epidemiological point of view, an outbreak point of view, to control things?
I think that the transition certainly we've seen over the last few weeks is an interesting one. Cause I think early on there was that almost vacuum of evidence and information because it was so new. And so you had speculation filling and all this kind of thing. But I think now we are in a very serious situation. So, you know, having people drumming this up and saying we need to do this and that, well, you know, we are doing this and that. We're kind of in this situation. I think people do seem to be turning more to wanting that kind of digestible source rather than this kind of constant round of speculation. But I think we do still see things taking off. And certainly over the last few weeks, there have been examples. Particularly early on, there was a lot of more the conspiracy theory type thing. And I think because of it's the speed at which these things can take off. And I think that the demand for early information, that it's, even if you look at some of these sort of chains of spread, something goes from quite a fringe tweet to a mainstream talking point in almost a matter of hours. And so there's not always those checks, maybe with a slightly slower news cycle. I'm not saying we can go back to the old days, but it does mean that things very quickly can suddenly rise to prominence. Whereas it might be harder if, you know, if there's kind of people getting their news once a day for that to happen.
And things like photographs of people queuing outside supermarkets or shelves, they might be the exception to the rule, and yet they're causing other people to do the same. There's an amazing piece of behavioural psychology to look at, you know, as a case study of the last few weeks, isn't there? What do you feel when you're watching, when you're seeing that unfold, and you know what you know about the spread of ideas and virus?
And it's this really, and I think it's one thing that going back to a lot of, I mean, this is obviously happening, but it's not clear how much it's happening. But even the sort of spread of these you know, more fake, dodgy news stories, it's the challenge on how to report on those things without amplifying them. And I think that's something where certainly over the last few years, a lot of outlets and, you know, prominent people online have been played quite heavily, because You know, people know that if they throw something unreliable or outrageous at them, that person, even if they comment on it and say, look, this is outrageous, that's just amplifying it. And I think we do have this balance to strike in the current outbreak, that you need that reporting on kind of what's happening, but equally you don't want to be putting loads of images out there on, you know, the one shop with a queue on it, because that would give people obviously a very strong behavioral nudge to do the same thing.
Again, there's the paradox is, as an epidemiologist, you're looking for the exception to the rule. When you're looking for something in terms of creative communication, creativity, you mentioned your wife works in advertising. There's a book of rules. There's parameters that we all have to work by, testing, process. And then actually the thing that breaks through the outbreak is something that comes out of nowhere. How do we, as a culture, as industry, as individuals, prepare ourselves to spot, this is the impossible question, but I'm going to ask it, to spot that exception without being distracted by fake news and irrelevance?
I think it is incredibly tough because everything is essentially competing for our attention. But I think, and one of the things the book tries to do is separate these kind of it's almost like the principles of things that do spread and what's driving that, because it's certainly not the case that you can show me a tweet and I can say that's going to get 156 retweets or this kind of thing. But you can say, well, actually the way that's going in and the connections you have, this is the most likely, if it does go viral, this is the most likely path it will take. And I think thinking more about those kind of underlying drivers rather than, I think what does happen in many industries is we look at a past successful thing and say, if we do that again, then we'll get the same results. And I think that's the thing to avoid. It's like, you know, in outbreaks, the danger is always you say, oh, this looks a bit like this virus, so it's probably going to behave the same. And then it doesn't. And then people are surprised. Whereas actually, if you look, I mean, one example that we did, for instance, was with Ebola post 2016. I think there was this idea that we have a vaccine now, it's always going to be controllable. But looking at the underlying transmission that was going on during that outbreak in West Africa, we realized that if cases weren't being followed up by contact tracing, which is exactly the issue we now have with COVID-19, if those cases are being missed, we actually found that they tend to spark super spreading events because they don't know they're infected. They go about their business and that can lead to mass transmission. So if you have that dynamic going on, we estimated that you could quite easily get another large outbreak happening despite vaccination being in place. And that's what happened in the Democratic Republic of Congo over the last couple of years. And so I think it's separating this more kind of descriptive way of thinking about it, of this happened, therefore it's going to happen again, from, well, actually, where are these links and how are these things spreading? And is there a gap here that might be something that can be repeated again?
How does mathematics, data, how does that approach to a global problem where each data set is different in each country? Yeah. How do you bring that together with different cultures and different from east to west, north and south?
So I think what we do in a lot of our work is try and take those very diverse data sets and often very contradictory data sets, and first of all find obvious ways of kind of adjusting them to make some sort of fair comparison. So one example would be, for example, looking at the number of deaths and cases being reported in different areas. If your outbreak's increasing, if you imagine there's this delay from a case, someone becoming ill to death. So if you have a very quickly rising case curve, that suggests your deaths are going to be rising in future. Whereas if you have a declining curve, your deaths in future are probably going to decline. So you have to kind of think about those differences before you make any comparison. So that's one example, but we do that on a lot of data sets. We adjust out for obvious reasons that the data might be different. And then if we get a consistent story between them, great. If we don't, then we try and identify other obvious factors. So one we've seen recently between countries is really what's being reported in terms of cases and deaths suggests that some countries are reporting a lot more cases than others. We estimate places like Korea and Germany are probably catching a lot more of their cases than somewhere like the UK. But if you look at how things, you know, the UK is not testing most symptomatic cases, Germany probably are. So that kind of makes sense. So I think with all these things, it's trying to adjust so we can make fair comparisons and then find the simplest explanation for those differences. And one of the other things we do often is, you know, we'll look at maybe half a dozen different data sets. Say we're testing to see if there's been a reduction in transmission. You know, we'll look at six different data sets from a similar area, and then we'll do the analysis with and without different data sets and see if we get the same conclusion. And ideally we will, and if we don't, then it gives us some idea of what we can and can't trust.
You mentioned Germany there and Korea. Russia must be a big problem, America, but you know, you're dealing with such huge data sets. How do you mitigate for the flow of information from different regimes, different cultural democracies or non-democracies or totalitarian states? How do you filter that?
So what we'll often do is we'll look at external data as well. So a lot of the early signals. So for example, this was at end of February, I guess now, when Iran, their first two cases reported were two deaths. And as soon as we saw that, just doing a back of the envelope, we just thought, well, you know, we know probably about 100 symptomatic cases are ill. It takes about 3 weeks from becoming ill to death. So two deaths. So about 3 weeks ago, there were probably about 200 cases, and they've been growing in that subsequent 3 weeks or so. So if you imagine exponential growth, you're probably looking at about 1,000 cases at the point those two deaths were reported. But then another group in Canada did a slightly different calculation. And they said, well, we noticed that a couple of travelers in other countries have a travel history to Iran and have been infected. So based on traveler flows and sort of movements, what's the chance that, you know, the outbreak is only a handful of people, given that a couple of travelers had already managed to get infected and go somewhere else? And they did a rough calculation, and they put it in the sort of few thousands. So there are these approaches you can use under the assumption that what's being reported really isn't capturing the full story.
Even though pandemics are different, you say they follow a trajectory that is common between spark, peak, growth, and decline. Yeah. I would assume we're heading towards the peak globally.
So I think that's certainly, you know, a good way of thinking about outbreaks in terms of, is it growing? Is it peaking? What's causing it to peak? I think we probably are heading towards the peak, but because we're putting these measures in place, the reason for the decline isn't because everyone's got immunity and it can't spread anymore. It's because we've forced down transmission. So if we go back to normal, we're in a situation where there's no reason it couldn't increase again. So I think that's why understanding what's caused the peak is really important. We estimate in China, for example, in Wuhan, that although they caused it to peak and reduce transmission, probably about 95% of Wuhan, we estimated, was still susceptible. So there's no reason to think if they return to normal, you wouldn't get an outbreak. I think even when we look at much smaller outbreaks, I think that's a really important question to ask, because sometimes, especially with kind of randomness early on, the peak of an outbreak might just be chance, that, you know, that group of people just happen to be in a house and not meet other people. And I think understanding that explanation for did it peak because it wasn't transmissible, or did it peak because something else happened? And I think across all fields, when we're looking at contagion, we need to actually think about why was this going up and why did it come down?
I mean, you didn't know about COVID-19 when you wrote Rules of Contagion, but the notion of susceptibility, I mean, it works across every area in life where you're talking about ideas. Just because a culture is susceptible to a good idea or a bad idea at one point doesn't mean they're going to be next week or next year. Yeah. And then because of all sorts of conditions, economic, cultural, social, political, they might be again.
I think one of the good things about this outbreak in terms of the response has been people are making insights available very quickly. So we're trying to get online dashboards up as quickly as we can. So we've got quite a lot of things that we're trying to get out and updated, just to provide situation. Yeah, these questions of how many cases are we seeing, how fast is it spreading, all this kind of stuff. So I think just making sure that it's updated so people have, in this quite messy picture, you know, the clearest idea they can.
Thanks for joining us. You've definitely thrown light on what is a fast moving situation, but also with insights that I think are applicable for the future and help us navigate our way through this current time. Thank you very much, Adam.
All right, thank you.